Welcome and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. On this week's episode, NAHU's Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman unpack the Trump administration's follow-up guidance to the state relief and empowerment waivers that included four concepts for how states can take advantage of the new flexibility. They also discuss their meeting with key Treasury Department officials on the HRA proposed rule, the ongoing actions in the lame duck session, and what the incoming congressional leadership could mean for health policy next year. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop for the Washington Update podcast this week is the release of four concept waivers as part of the Section 1332 State Relief and Empowerment Waivers. This comes as part of the guidance that was released in October to provide greater state flexibility for their healthcare markets. What are these concepts that CMS has offered, and how could they work as states begin to submit applications?
Like Dan mentioned, this is a continuation of the guidance that we received in October from CMS to make it a bit easier for states to apply for 1332 waivers, which they're kind of rebranding as state relief and empowerment waivers. And when they released that guidance in October, we were told that they were going to be working on what they were calling waiver concepts, or what they're trying to use as somewhat of a model or suggestions for states to use. I believe CMS Administrator Seema Verma referred to them as a menu for states to choose from. And so this week we received a notice from CMS that they came out with a paper that has four suggestions for the waiver concepts that states can use. One is to request a waiver for account-based subsidies. And under this waiver, a state can direct public subsidies into a defined contribution consumer-directed account that an individual uses to pay for health insurance premiums or other healthcare expenses. The account can be funded with pass-through funding made available by waiving the premium tax credits or by waiving the small business healthcare tax credit. The account would also allow individuals to aggregate their funding from additional sources, so they could include both individual and employer contributions into their account. This approach could give beneficiaries more choices and require them, the administration believes, to be able to take on more responsibility for managing their healthcare spending. I think this really goes more to kind of the backpack approach of individuals being able to really take what they have with them and be responsible for what they're choosing. Another option would be the state-specific premium assistance. And with this concept, states can use the waiver to create a new state-administered subsidy program. With this, the subsidy structure would meet the unique needs of the population in order to provide more affordable healthcare options to a wider range of individuals, attract more young and healthy consumers into their market, and address structural issues that create different types of incentives. And this reminds me most of what we saw in the Graham-Cassidy bill that we saw last year in the Senate's attempt to go towards repeal, replace, repair language, where the bill would have allowed for the funds that were going toward premium tax credits for individuals in a state would be given to the state, and they could kind of decide how they were going to put together healthcare reform and allow for subsidies within their border. So I think this waiver is the closest to that.
With the Graham-Cassidy legislation, as we were looking at repeal and replace efforts, would have provided all of the money available under the ACA back to the states. This is providing more flexibility to allow the states to use the money in unique ways, but the money still starts off with the federal government, and this is state-specific. The state's going to have to apply for these 1332 waivers. In Graham-Cassidy, all the money was going to the states if the states wanted it or not.
Yes, I think this is the closest that they could come to suggesting this going through the agencies and not through legislation with Congress.
I still think there'll be some controversy around this proposal. And I think you'll see this coming from progressive groups over the coming weeks as more information is published about this. A lot of controversy that the guardrails that are in the ACA and the rules around 1332 waivers are not actually being complied with, this new guidance that's coming out from the department. So do expect this to be somewhat controversial out there as it's coming together, because I think there are groups who are concerned that consumer protections will not be in place.
The guidance does try to put a caveat that the guardrails are still in place, and that's the guidance that came out today, but it does seem to contradict the guidance that came out in October. The third concept that the waivers are suggesting is an adjusted plan option where states would be able to provide financial assistance for different types of health insurance plans, including non-QHPs, so non-qualified health plans, potentially increasing consumer choice and making coverage more affordable for individuals. And they give the example that states could choose to expand the availability of catastrophic plans beyond the current eligibility limitations. So I think here what we would really be looking at is the possibility of states doing this type of waiver. And when we look back at the guardrails and making sure they're having the same type of comprehensive coverage, the concern here would be that they are applying this to non-QHPs, so they wouldn't have the 10 essential health benefits. And you'll see that in the example here by them suggesting to extend the coverage for catastrophic plans. And then the fourth option under the waiver concepts is one that we are the biggest fans of, and this is the risk stabilization strategies. And this would address risk associated with individuals with high healthcare costs. The waiver concept gives states more flexibility to implement reinsurance programs, also known as high risk pools. And they give the example that a state can implement a state operated reinsurance program or high risk pool by waiving the single risk pool requirement that's currently under the ACA. And what we've seen from the few states that have already attempted to put together a reinsurance plan, about six states have been approved for a reinsurance plan through the waivers, but these programs have lowered premiums for consumers, improved the market stability in their states, and increased consumer choice. So we are looking forward to seeing the risk stabilization strategies concept being adopted by more and more states moving forward. And with this example, along with the flexibility that was put forward in the October guidance, I think that it's going to make it more and more realistic for states to be able to adopt these programs. And with the risk stabilization strategies, again, this is allowing a pass-through by reducing federal spending and the premium tax credits. And kind of comparing this again, like we were to Congress's attempts of doing this, I think this is more closely to the Collins-Nelson bill that we saw last year, with Congress trying to allow funding for federal and then state-specific high-risk pools. And this is a waiver that allows states to be able to do this, but again, through the pass-through funding from the premium tax credits.
The House Democrats held their caucus leadership elections this week and nominated Nancy Pelosi to be Speaker. That vote will come to the floor in January, where she must win the support of 218 members, 15 more than the Democrats who supported her in the caucus vote. What are some of the key takeaways from the leadership elections, and what could they portend for the session ahead?
So we're recording this on Thursday afternoon. The Democrats are still in the process of their leadership election. Their leadership elections are taking place this Wednesday and today, Thursday. We'll start off at the top of it with the Speaker. So Nancy Pelosi has been renominated by the party to be Speaker. It's a two-part process, though. Your party first nominates you, and then you have to win a vote on the full House floor. In the caucus where Nancy Pelosi was renominated, the vote was for Nancy Pelosi, or you could vote no. And so there was about 30 members there who voted no against Nancy Pelosi. There was not an actual candidate put up against Nancy Pelosi like there has been in the past. Last Congress, Tim Ryan ran against her for the leader. This time it's for Speaker. But she's had an actual opponent. Her opposition has tried over the last few weeks organizing around a possible opponent. Marcia Fudge from Ohio was for quite a while floated as a possible opponent for her, but in the end she decided not to run. So you had about 30 people who voted no. A lot of these are members who campaigned on voting no and campaigned back in their districts that they would vote no, and they've now followed through with that pledge to vote against Nancy Pelosi. So I think when looking at the full House floor vote, which will come up on January 3rd, you'll now have Nancy Pelosi versus Congressman McCarthy. The Republicans have nominated to be the speaker. And so now you have two people against each other. The scenario here is a little bit different. There are several different things a Democratic member who does not care for Nancy Pelosi could do in this particular case. The most unlikely would be to vote for McCarthy. And I don't particularly expect any of them to do for that. Some of them may vote for other people who are not nominated. Every year, there's always different people who receive some votes for speaker. And then the other option for these people are to vote present, which means that they're there, but they choose not to vote for somebody for speaker. I expect a fair amount of those 30 people who voted against her to vote present on the House floor during that vote, because they casted their no vote in caucus against her, but up against a Republican alternative. They're not going to vote for them, and so we're a lot more likely to vote present. Voting present does have a change on the overall threshold, because to become speaker, you need to just have the majority of the votes cast in the election, and if you vote present, that comes against the total number of votes there. So you actually start to lower the threshold for becoming speaker. And so I think that's also one of the ways that you'll see her possibly take the speakership with less than 218 votes, because the threshold you will need will have been decreased by people voting present. I think because the opposition could never really rally around one particular candidate, I think that will be how she will hold on. I also think, you know, a lot of people who thought that Nancy Pelosi might be defeated were talking about a House where the Democrats were running it by 5-10 seats. They took 40 seats in this election, larger than a lot of people were predicting. And so that makes it much easier for her to come back into power.
The importance with Nancy Pelosi possibly winning the speakership on the House side when we're looking at healthcare is that she has mentioned that if she were to obtain the leadership role as speaker for this coming session, that she would look at repairs to the ACA and not moving further into some of the more left-leaning areas like Medicare for All, or looking at a way of revamping the entire healthcare system. So I think looking at those fixes are things that we've been looking to do, which will be helpful for us to have a speaker that's in that position. And then also going back to the way that the votes are tallied and that Chris mentioned, folks are more likely to vote present if they don't want to go on the record voting for Nancy Pelosi, although it does happen, less likely to vote for someone else other than her if they are in the party of the majority. And of course, this does come back to bite people from time to time, where there can be a little tally of a list of folks that did not vote specifically for the speaker who ends up obtaining power and having some difficulty in getting their bills heard down the line, usually only for a few months after the election of a speaker, but it does take its toll in some ways. So we are always looking at that, especially when we're looking at folks that we're working with and making sure that they're folks that can work with everyone. And another impact that Nancy Pelosi will have if voted into being the speaker for the House is today she announced that she would lead the House counsel into defending the ACA and intervening in the lawsuit that is taking place now, Texas versus the United States. You'll remember this is the lawsuit that is currently pending in the lower courts. It was heard September 5th, and we haven't received the judgment from the lower court judge just yet, but it is expected to be appealed regardless of the result from the judge. And this is where the Republican attorneys general are challenging the individual mandate because it was zeroed out in December 2017 tax bill. And they're arguing that with a zeroing out of the individual mandate penalty, that individual mandate itself is unconstitutional, along with other pieces of the ACA that are attached to it, such as possible coverage for pre-existing conditions and guaranteed issue. There are a group of Democratic attorneys general that are defending this and saying that it's not the case, that the individual mandate still does exist as a tax because the tax was just zeroed out and not repealed, but then also that these aspects of the ACA shouldn't be severed from the individual mandate if it is found unconstitutional. So the fact that Nancy Pelosi has announced that the House Council will be intervening in this when the Democrats take the majority in the House in January, it will be very influential for healthcare coming down the line in the future.
As you look through the rest of the Democratic leadership, we still have a lot of the same leaders who were there before. Steny Hoyer in the second position, James Clyburn in the third position. We're talking about all people who are in their 70s. A lot of people are still looking for generational change. I think you start to get that as you come down to the next few positions there. After that, the next position is now going to be held by Ben Ray Lujan. He was the chair of the DCCC, much younger member in his 50s, Latino from New Mexico. Part of that new generation. The next position after that is the caucus chair. There was a race in this one. It's one of the positions that were truly contested in a tight race between Barbara Lee, African-American congresswoman from the Bay Area of California, versus Hakeem Jeffries from New York City, African-American male. This was really competitive race that was down to the wire. Hakeem Jeffries was the eventual winner. I think some of this might also be generational again. He is in his 40s. I think we're all looking for that generational change. Barbara Lee was in her 70s. And I think the next generation is looking for more and more leadership in that area. The vice chair of the caucus is going to be Kathleen Clark of Massachusetts. I think this provides another woman into the leadership. Also, somebody who's not in that category of 70-year-olds again. She was running against a member from California who was also younger. So you're seeing some of these positions again start to develop new leaders. The DCCC just recently had their election. There was originally four candidates. One of them dropped off three. But the eventual winner of that was Sherry Bustos from Illinois, downstate Illinois, not Chicago area. I think this gives the Democrats somebody from middle America, so it's not all just coast to coast. The DCCC is also what runs the election apparatus of the Democratic Party and what they'll be using to go into the next election. So I think you have a true impact of the Midwest now in that leadership, where it's not just California and New York and Massachusetts running everything, and I think a lot of people are pleased to see that. The Democrats will continue to do their elections for the rest of the day for lower-level positions. Again, I think you're likely to see younger, more diverse, more females winning those positions. I think there'll be less of a battle about is someone more liberal or conservative, and it's going to be more about can we get some new people, new blood in there, and really grooming people to take over for Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Jace Clyburn, because they cannot stay in that leadership forever, and we need some new blood in there, and I think that's the way the party will go. What this means for healthcare is I think it provides some stability, people who know what they're talking about when it comes to healthcare policy. I also think this puts some brakes to the Medicare for All movement in there, and I think you'll have people who know how to broker compromise and pragmatism in there. So I think this does in the House put some brakes on the Medicare for All growing movement there, and so we're pleased to see that.
NAHU, along with the Partnership for Employer-Sponsored Coverage, met with key Treasury Department officials this week to discuss the HRA regulations and other employer issues. What were some of the key takeaways from this meeting?
So we went in with the Partnership for Employer-Sponsored Coverage and Christine Pollack, who heads up that group. She has been a guest here on the podcast previously, talking about where we are with our employer issues, specifically on employer reporting and legislation that we have tried to put forward for a prospective reporting system. So we were with her and the rest of the coalition at the Treasury Department earlier this week, talking about the proposed rule for HRAs. And what we're seeing so far from the proposal is that it would seemingly be an extension of what we have seen just a couple of years ago with the QSERAs, or the qualified small employer HRAs. However, this would allow for larger employers to be able to use this. It allows for integrated HRAs. Then this really spurns a lot of questions about how this is going to work. And so that was a lot of the conversation that we had with the Treasury Department, exactly how employers are going to be able to do this and comply with the rules, which are also part of what our comments are going to be. We've worked really closely with our subcommittee of the Legislative Council, the Employer Working Group, to put together comments based on what was in the proposed rule. And like I said, a lot of this hinges on compliance, and the fact that the proposed rule doesn't take into account a lot of the current employer reporting rules and how they're going to keep track of folks that are getting onto these HRAs, how they're going to make sure that compliance is seen both on the individual side and the employer side. So these were some of the questions that we brought up in the meeting. The Treasury Department, of course, can't promise anything when they're having these meetings. A lot of their responses were really trying to solicit comments in written form and making sure that we put those together. Some of the other requests in the meeting were based on, again, how the employers are going to put this together. In the proposed rule, there are a lot of notices and different communications that need to go to the employees, but there aren't actual examples of how this is supposed to happen. And so this was something else that was brought up in our meeting with Treasury, and they said they were kind of hesitant to put together any model notices, which is something that we've seen with previous regulations, specifically with regulations that were a derivative of the ACA. And NEHU has tried to put notices together and put together samples. One that comes to mind is the PII model that we put together. But these are a little more technical. And so it was interesting that Treasury was not interested in putting the models together. Although they say that now, I think it's a different story if this does get into a final rulemaking and these notices are still required. With the level of complexity that was included in the proposed rule, I think it's hard for Treasury to say, we're not going to give you a model, but we're going to impose these very technical requirements for communications between employers and employees, but we're not going to tell you how. And so I think even though we're getting the message now that the models are less likely for some of these notices, like I said, it becomes a different story when this is actually something that's becoming law. And I think that's something else to keep in mind when we're looking at the other aspects of the proposed rule. And our strategy at NEHU is to really ask questions about how this is supposed to be implemented. Even though the proposed rule was, I think, almost 300 pages, there were a lot of specifics that were left out. They did provide us guidance following up on some of the employer reporting issues in about a 30-page notice that followed the proposed rule. But there's still left a lot to be wanted as far as specific instructions for employers. And that's really what we're going to be asking for.
Marcy, when you were in with the coalition meeting at Treasury, what other topics did they cover?
We also talked about those 226J letters that people have been getting and suggestions for clear reporting to prevent employers from ever getting that 226J letter. Although the IRS has a really great page about what to do if you get one of those letters, I think everyone, us and the employer groups that were represented in this coalition, none of us want to get to the point where an employer is getting a 226J letter. We want to make sure that they're able to understand how to do the reporting and that they're only getting one of those letters if they were not in compliance with offering affordable coverage, where we saw this past year, about 80% of the letters that went out were because of some type of faulty or mistakes made during the reporting process. And just requesting that the reporting guidelines are a little clearer. And again, promoting our prospective reporting system that we've been working on with Congress. Of course, the Treasury Department as an agency cannot actively lobby Congress for changes like these, but we did mention it to let them know that we are working on making things simpler for them to implement by working with Congress. Another thing that we mentioned while we were there was, of course, the Cadillac tax. As many of you know, it is now slated to go into effect January 1st of 2022, which is just around the corner. We know a lot of employers have already started to make plans on how they're putting together their plan designs based on an implementation date of 2022. However, we don't have the rules and the regulations from Treasury about exactly how that's going to be put together. It is slated in the schedule from the agencies for 2019 in September for something to come out from them on this. And so when we asked that, the career folks at Treasury seemed to be a little hesitant to really commit to that timeline of something coming out in September 2019. So it seems as though we may be waiting a little bit longer before we see those much anticipated regulations on how the Cadillac tax will be implemented.
Congress is in the process of drafting their end-of-year tax package for the lame duck session. What are some of the key components of this package, And how have NIHU's priorities factored into these discussions?
Right now, we see a draft package from the House of Representatives for an end-of-year package on appropriations. And appropriations really being the most important piece right now of what they're looking at, because the government closes starting December 7th. It's out of funding. And so they've put together a package that funds the government through the new year. That package tends to be rather narrow and is heavily weighted towards funding the border wall with Mexico. However, this particular package that's been put together on the House side is not likely to attract much Democratic support. And so we expect the Senate to come up with a different funding package over the same time period. There'll be some question if any tax provisions whatsoever make it into a end of the year package, be it healthcare taxes or other sorts of extenders, different corporate subsidies and others. I think there's more of a conversation when it comes to tax policy now around for March, when we see the debt ceilings and others come into place. So all sorts of tax issues, I think, are more likely to be happening in March than they are now. That being said, we've spent October and November talking to the tax policy people in both the House and the Senate on both sides of the aisles about issues like the Cadillac tax and how it needs to be repealed, about the HIT tax and how it's just adding cost onto plans, about employer reporting and about that burden that it's putting on employers in order to provide people healthcare. So we are set and in place if the package at some point becomes a larger package. And because of that need to negotiate between the House and the Senate on their different versions, does that open up a possibility for us to be included? And so we are going to keep that pressure on for if there is a break in that package at some point where people feel that they need to make changes to the packages in order to find a way of getting the same bill passed the House and the Senate. And, you know, this is happening at the same time. There's a lot of pressure to get out of town. This is the old Congress, so these are not the members of Congress who were just elected. And everybody knows that the dynamic will change drastically come January, so that there'll be a lot of pressure to try to get this wrapped up by the end of the year. And there's that pressure of the government shutting down on December 7th that will also be looming over them. So stay tuned to see what exactly happens. I think there are a lot of different dynamics left to happen between the House and the Senate, but also with President Trump. Is this package that they developed something that he's going to be comfortable with, or is he going to feel a need to veto it, which I think particularly if he does not get funding for that border wall will be something he's very interested in.
It's now time for the NIHU Healthcare Happy Hours Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to?
This week, we're toasting to CMS Administrator Seema Verma for coming out and announcing the waiver concepts for the state relief and empowerment waivers. We're looking forward to working with our states as they seek relief with reinsurance waivers and looking at the other types of concept waivers that they can implement.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NIHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NIHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NIHU, visit nihu.org.